Right, here we go. Didactic Mind, episode 29, Deep Sixing the Deep State. A very warm welcome to all of my readers from the blog. A very warm welcome to all of my SoundCloud subscribers. I'm very happy to have you here as we go through another episode of the Didactic Mind podcast. If you have not subscribed already, please make sure you do so that you never miss a new podcast or upload. And please make sure you stop by the blog, because honestly, I express myself much better in written form than I do in spoken, in my personal opinion, of course. So if you want this sort of stuff in a perhaps less rambling fashion, the blog is the place for you. So today I want to talk about something that is quite topical, particularly with the news that the charges against Lieutenant General Flynn, Michael Flynn, have been essentially dropped by the Department of Justice in the United States, and the subsequent decision by Judge Sullivan of the, whatever it was, the federal court, whether it's the federal court or the local court, I can't quite remember which, but basically the judge involved in the case said that he wanted to see arguments from the prosecution as to why the case shouldn't be dropped. Now, this is a bit weird, because the government said, the Department of Justice under the Attorney General said very clearly, we believe the charges against the general should be dropped. The Department of Justice is the department pursuing the case against the general. That's ultimately the department responsible. So the judge in the case is basically saying to the DOJ, I don't accept your own decision to drop your own case, and I want to pursue this further. Now, there is, as of yet, no reason for the DOJ to file an appeal to an appeals court and ask for the judge's motion to be dismissed, because all the judge has said is, you now have to prepare some arguments for and against dropping the case. Well, okay, fine. But the problem here is the fact that the judge made this motion in the first place. What was the point of this? Why did he do this? The Department of Justice, which is the government branch for which you know, acts as the enforcement arm of the executive branch, has just been told by the legislative branch of government, your own powers do not apply in this case. So it's a classic case of the legislative branch, the judicial branch telling the executive branch what it can do. That is a direct and flagrant violation of the Constitution, of course, as anybody who studies such matters will know. The problem with this line of thinking is that basically it presupposes that the Constitution is still the law of the land in the United States of America. It is not, and has not been for a very long time. This is a tragedy. Make no mistake about that. I yield to no one in my deference for and respect for the Constitution of the United States of America. I believe it is the finest framework of governance ever devised by merely human intelligences. Those intelligences were incredible. That's a fact. I mean, the men behind the creation of this document were astonishing. Their intellects, their achievements in life, their wisdom, their foresight, everything about that made America great came from the minds of these men. Just men. Divinely guided, divinely inspired, but merely men. And look at what they came up with. The Constitution is an incredible document. It fuses the best traditions of all the various kind of preceding versions of government that came in the past. Monarchy, aristocracy, democracy, into something like a cohesive whole, into something of a practical framework. And even in its original incarnation, of course, the Constitution, as ratified in 1789, was far from perfect. There were a lot of problems with the Constitution as it was envisioned at the time. There was a raging debate, in fact, between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. And of course, I mean, this is famous stuff. You can read the Federalist Papers, which argued for the creation of a federal government, and the Anti-Federalists, which argued against it. And the Anti-Federalists had some very good points. They said that the protections of individual rights are not strong enough in the Constitution as it is currently written. They were absolutely 100% correct. And 10 years after America finally won its actual independence with the British surrender at Yorktown, that is exactly what happened. The Anti-Federalists made their point, but they didn't make it strongly enough. So the Constitution had to go back and be revised, and that was where the Bill of Rights came in. But that Constitution, as it was built and as it was ratified at the time, didn't really last more than 100 years. By the time the war between the states rolled around, the Constitution was effectively a dead letter, and had been for a few years by that time. But even as bad as things got during the war between the states, the Constitution was still held as at least the letter of the law. The spirit of the law was not obeyed. The spirit of the law said very clearly, the government shall be the servant of the people, not the other way around. But the letter of the law, at least, was obeyed. And there have been many attempts since the time of the war between the states to bring the federal government back in line with the vision of the founders. Some have been more successful than others. One of the most successful, of course, was the presidency of St. Ronald Magnus of the Right. Ronald Reagan tried hard to slow the growth of government, reduce its power, and stop it from interfering in the lives of citizens. And in some respects, he was very successful. He did continue the deregulation trend set by his predecessor. This is something most conservatives don't want to admit. Most people on the right don't want to admit this, but the reality is that deregulation did not start under Reagan. It actually started under Carter. President Carter was the one who started off the trend towards deregulation. President Carter was the one who appointed Fed Chairman Volcker, who reestablished a hard money standard and really broke the back of inflation in the United States. President Carter was behind a lot of the initial successes of the Reagan presidency. And Reagan had the wisdom and the good sense to understand that these policies needed to be continued. Now, Jimmy Carter was a disaster in most other respects and is rightly regarded as one of the worst presidents the United States has ever had. But he did do some things right. What made Reagan so great was recognizing that his predecessor had some good ideas, continuing those good ideas, and of course co-opting them for his own. And that's fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with the successor claiming credit for his predecessor's policies, as long as he continues to enact them successfully. There's a lot wrong with a successor claiming to repudiate his predecessor's policies and then continuing on with them anyway, as was the case with Barack O'Dumbass the Lightworker, who came into office basically saying he was the anti-Bush, and then essentially not only continued his predecessor's policies, but like doubled, tripled, quadrupled, and in some cases quintupled down upon them. But this is the point that we are led to today, where the Constitution no longer really means anything. Not for the individual, not for the government. And the reason for that is because of the deep state. The deep state, as we understand it, is essentially a shadowy parallel government. It's not beholden to the people in any way. It's not elected. It consists of bureaucrats who serve for life, pretty much, who work the levers of power to maintain the bureaucracy. It consists of intelligence agencies who are not subjected to congressional oversight and who do not have their inner workings exposed to the American public, who have been given tremendous power over the American people for no good reason. It consists of people who all went to the same schools who live in the same zip codes, who all think the same ways, and who all believe the same things. They all believe ultimately in the preservation of a neoliberal world order. That world order essentially says, or believes in the following creeds. First, that open borders are a good thing, that cheap labor is good, because it drives down costs and increases profits. Second, that a small intellectual elite absolutely has the right to govern over the rest of us, because they know better. They have the education, they have the wisdom, they have the skills, they have the qualifications. You will notice, by the way, that this attitude is very, very, very similar to that espoused by the Chinese. The Chinese have long believed in the notion that the most educated and the most qualified are the ones who should rise to the top through merit. Now, meritocracy is a wonderful thing in a lot of ways, but it's not a perfect solution to society's problems. It leads to some very, very unbalanced outcomes. Pure meritocracy would mean that the smartest and the most qualified get to the top, but that is not necessarily to say that the wisest and the most experienced get to the top. There's a strong distinction between the two. Achievement is strongly correlated with intelligence, but wisdom is not correlated with intelligence, not particularly strongly. Some of the smartest people, or at least in terms of raw IQ, some of the most bright people that I've ever met, the brightest people that I've ever met, are profoundly, astonishingly inept and stupid in real-world applications. This is where I draw the distinction between being smart and being bright. Being bright, or being intelligent, simply means having a high IQ. It means having a lot of intellectual horsepower. To give you an example, I personally have an IQ, you know, the last time I measured it, was supposedly at 135. It could be 139 or 141, you know, as high as that, depending on how you measure based on SAT scores. I don't really put much credence to that. I know I am highly intelligent. I don't particularly care about my raw IQ score. But that isn't actually particularly impressive. It's just, you know, it's dick measuring, okay? There are people who read my blog who have IQs of 145 to 155. Quite a few of them, in fact. Lieutenant Colonel Tom Kratman, who is a regular reader of my blog, has an IQ of about 150. Last Readout has an IQ of roughly 150. One of my readers who lives in Florida has an IQ of like 145, 150, thereabouts. There are many people who read my blog who make me look stupid, okay? The raw intelligence is not that impressive. What matters is achievement. What matters is wisdom. What matters is actual applicable skill. And in this respect, the deep staters believe, contrary to all actual human experience, that intelligence matters more than achievement. And that's not true. That isn't at all the case. What matters is not intelligence. What matters is practical application of intelligence. But the deep state believes otherwise. The deep state believes that because they are the most qualified, they all went to the best schools, they have the rights to rule over the rest of us. And that's simply led us down some very, very blind and terrible, dangerous paths. The deep state types were the types that said it was a good idea to go to war in Iraq over non-existent weapons of mass destruction. The deep state types were the ones who said that it was a good idea to establish an American empire overseas, that it was a good idea to occupy Afghanistan and tear it down and rebuild it as a thriving, vibrant, liberal democracy. These people are wedded to their own preconceived notions. For all their much vaunted intelligence, they're actually astonishingly stupid. Their third principle of power is power, basically. That they must be given power and they must hold on to it without respect for anything that any of us want. The rest of us are just, you know, the great unwashed masses. They are the ones who have the right to power through superior breeding, intelligence, education, and circumstances. And that's good for them. They believe that this is a good thing. Never mind what the rest of us think. It doesn't matter. So these three principles, and there are many more, but these are the three, I think, primary principles, are the guiding beliefs of the deep staters. And these principles have led the United States into disaster followed by catastrophe with almost monotonous regularity. It is astonishing how stupid these people are, how venal, vindictive, foolish, but they will do anything to preserve power at all costs. And the result has been a centralization of power in not just the United States of America, but around the world, to a degree that is genuinely terrifying. The reality is that a very small number of elite people around the world control the lives and fortunes of billions of other people. If you look not just in the United States, but in Canada or Britain or anywhere else in Europe, it's the same story writ large, over and over again. A small cluster of government officials who are beholden to nothing and no one, who have no mandate given by the people, combined with billionaires, with tremendous, influence. Tremendous influence within the governments themselves. Intelligence officials and public health officials or public faces have power to a degree that should be frightening for the rest of us, but for some reason, for a long time, wasn't. Now, what does all this have to do with General Michael Flynn? General Flynn's case has been one of the catalysts in breaking up the monopoly grip that these people have on power. If you look at how this case has unfolded, it is a case study in the kind of insanity that runs rampant within the deep state. James Comey, former head of the FBI, bragged about sending FBI agents to interview General Flynn because the White House was chaotic. It was a transition of power between Odamas, the light workers' presidency, and the incoming presidency of his most illustrious, noble, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name. May the Lord bless him and preserve him. During that time of chaos and transition, James Comey basically said, "Yeah, you know what? Let's go get him. Let's do our best to take down these people." And he sent in FBI agents to interview General Flynn. They told him, "No, you don't need a lawyer." They explicitly told him, "You don't need a lawyer. This is just a Q&A session. We just want to talk about a few things." They asked him a question about his conversation with the Russian ambassador, Ambassador Kislyak. Kislyak is, as far as I know, was and still is the ambassador to the USA from the Neo-Tsar's government. Could be wrong about that, I'll have to go look it up, but anyway. Point is, General Flynn had a chat with the Russian ambassador. Nothing wrong with this, nothing unusual about this. It's normal for a national security advisor, an incoming NSA, to have talks with foreign dignitaries and officials, because that's the job of the NSA. It's to advise the president, in this case, his most majestic God Emperor, of threats to the national security of the United States. And one of the aspects of that job is talking to foreign plenipotentiaries. What's new about that? The problem is that in that conversation with the FBI, General Flynn said he didn't recall having a conversation with the Russian ambassador. Now, the FBI had already had General Flynn under wiretap surveillance. They'd already been tapping his phones, illegally, as it turns out. The FBI had been monitoring the Trump campaign illegally. They obtained a FISA search warrant illegally on the basis of absolutely bullshit information. We know this. I mean, all of this is a matter of public record at this point. The Steele dossier was bought and paid for by the Clinton campaign. We know this. That's been irrefutably established at this point. It was full of absolute nonsense, created by, again, a career bureaucrat and spy for the British government, who is beholden to nothing and nobody among the British people. And that dossier formed the basis of a FISA search warrant, a bogus warrant, that the FBI then used to try to bring down the Trump administration. Again, James Comey was an Obama appointee. He was very close to the Clintons, is very close to the Clintons. If you trace the networks back, what becomes very clear is a pattern of lies and corruption and deceit and malfeasance and nepotism that is absolutely horrifying to see. But the problem is that it's not just confined to the United States of America. This web of corruption is endemic throughout the rest of the world. It happens everywhere. It happens in India. There is a deep state entrenched in India, for sure. You just don't hear much about it because, I mean, honestly, with Indian politics, you know, the abiding principle to use in order to understand anything about Indian politics is that no matter who's in charge, the government is going to screw the people. It does not matter who's in charge. The government of India, all of the political parties of India are corrupt. And there's no question of this. They are all incompetent, they are all stupid, they are all idiotic. They all have a horrible way of approaching governance and power management. And they all end up befouling the seat of power. They all end up destroying the Indian people. That's part of the reason why India is a shithole country. It's because of its government, because it just doesn't matter who's in charge. It really doesn't matter who's in charge of the Indian government. Ultimately, it's the Indian people who pay the price. The Indian people will never benefit from good government because they're not capable of good government, all right? Honestly, in my personal opinion, the last time that the Indians had a good government was when the British were in charge. And that is absolute heresy. I mean, if an Indian says that, he's probably going to be the subject of lynch mobs, okay? He's probably going to get lynched. Just putting it out there, that's the reality. Such is Indian backwardness and nationalism and nationalistic fervor about the subject. But if you look at China, a lot of China observers admire the Chinese single-mindedness and tenacity and the ability of the Chinese Politburo to get things done fast. Well, that's not actually the case. The Chinese government does not operate quickly. The Chinese government operates off of a very entrenched deep state itself. In fact, the Chinese government is the literal definition of a deep state. If you look at the way the Chinese government operates, it's not through the mandate of the people. The Chinese Communist Party has made very sure that there will never be any such thing as Chinese democracy. And before anybody pipes in and says that Chinese are incapable of being democratic, well, that's simply not true. If you look at Taiwan, Taiwan is made up of both native Formosans and ethnic Chinese, ethnic Han Chinese. The Taiwanese have been able to maintain a stable democracy for, what, almost 50 years now? Something like that, because it was a one-party state. I mean, what was it called? The PPP? No, it wasn't that. I forget what exactly it was called, but it was Chiang Kai-shek's ruling party, fled from China and went to Taiwan and established themselves there and ruled as a military dictatorship until the death of Chiang Kai-shek. And then, you know, shortly thereafter, they freed themselves up and became a thriving, actually, democracy. South Korea is a democracy. Hong Kong was capable of holding its own democratic elections, and the people of Hong Kong had their own unique rights. Most of the people of Hong Kong are not actually Han Chinese. They are Cantonese. They speak Cantonese, so their demographics are a bit different. But the idea that East Asians aren't capable of at least some sort of involvement of ordinary people in politics is nonsense. They absolutely are. The Chinese, however, are the very the Chinese Communist Party, however, is the literal embodiment of deep state politics. If you want to know, if you want to understand what a government that is run by the deep state looks like, the Chinese Communist Party is the deep state. Okay, they choose who will succeed based on the competing interests of rival power factions. If you look at how the current Chinese leadership emerged, the fight for Xi Jinping's sort of rule over China started actually 30 years ago during the time of Deng Xiaoping's reign. Deng Xiaoping had a couple of hand-picked successors ready to go. But during the 90s, those hand-picked successors were kind of sidelined by party politics. And someone that he really didn't want, Deng Xiaoping didn't want him to attain power, obtained power. And that was Jiang Zemin. Now, Jiang Zemin is originally from Shanghai, not Beijing, which means that his power base in Beijing was basically non-existent. So he did what every communist supremo before him has always done. Just like Stalin, and just like other quote-unquote outsiders who came to power in a communist regime, he started purging those people who were not loyal to his way of doing things, and he started toppling power bases left and right. So the guy that Deng Xiaoping really wanted to lead China was actually Hu Jintao. Hu Jintao was the guy that Deng Xiaoping really wanted in charge. And he ended up in charge eventually, but he had to wait a long time to get there because Jiang Zemin was heavily involved in a lot of this these machinations designed to secure his own power base in Beijing and sideline Hu Jintao. And that's eventually what happened. Hu Jintao's premiership was not nearly as successful as it could have been. I mean, Premier Hu was very much of a mind with Deng. He wanted a liberalized market economy. He wanted a bit more freedom. I mean, he's still basically an East Asian Mandarin, which means that he can't conceive of anything other than an emperor in charge of an empire. But he did want more market-based economics, and he did want at least somewhat better relationships with the West. He wasn't quite so interested in playing the same kinds of imperialist power games that Xi Jinping has shown himself to be interested in. Now along eventually comes Xi Jinping to succeed all of this. Xi Jinping is the very epitome of a deep state product, but with a bit of a twist. He used to be in exile, as it happens. He was once in exile for something. I don't know his biography very well, but he came back. He fought and clawed his way through the ranks of the Communist Party on the basis of wit, intelligence, ruthlessness, and skill. And party connections, of course. I mean, that's, again, the way the deep state operates. He has absolutely no backing from the people to do what he's doing. He has no mandate by a popular vote. He does whatever he feels like, not necessarily in the name of his country. The thing about Chinese people is that it's kind of interesting. Chinese are avid and avowed nationalists. They believe very strongly in the primacy of the Middle Kingdom. They believe extremely strongly that China was always the natural leader of the entire world, and that this 500 year or so anomaly of history is going to go away very soon, because that's about how long it's been that the Chinese have not been top dog. In reality, it's been a lot longer than that, but the Chinese, in their own way of thinking, believe that, you know, compared with their glorious 5,000-year history, 500 years, 10% of their time in charge, it's no big deal. As far as they're concerned, China will once again rise to dominance. And, you know, in all fairness, it probably will. In many ways, it already has. the fact is that the United States cannot impose its will on China anymore. Hasn't been able to do so for some time. The Chinese have complete dominance over the South China Sea and are increasingly dominant in the Indian Ocean, in the South Pacific, and in the East Pacific. The American carrier fleets can do nothing in those regions, in those arenas, because carriers are actually incredibly vulnerable, and the turducken plane, as I call it, the flying turkey that is the F-35, is absolutely going to get slaughtered once it's out there in the open ocean, because war simulations have been conducted showing that while the F-35 is absolutely dominant once it's in the sky, which, by the way, I don't for one moment believe. I think that's absolute bullshit, but, you know, it's never been tested. But all the war simulations indicate that once the F-35 is in the air and flying around, shooting down enemies beyond visual range and is, you know, just dominating as an air superiority fighter, if you catch it napping on the ground, it gets slaughtered. It gets absolutely destroyed. And that, when you combine that with the F-35's massive reliability problems, I mean, it's only about 40% reliable at this point, and the extreme cost of the program and the all of the very well-documented problems with the plane. I mean, you can search for F-35 on my blog, and I've been writing about this for like 5 years, something like that, maybe more. I think the F-35 was a colossal and tragic mistake and should be canceled and scrapped and needs to be sent right back to the drawing board. And, you know, the United States needs to start crash development of a number of new fighter projects, fighter and attack plane projects, very, very quickly, for much lower cost than this absolute abomination of a plane. But anyway, the reality is that the United States can't do a damn thing in the Pacific arena anymore, and increasingly will not be able to do very much in the Atlantic arena either. It's not that, you know, it's not that the United States is toothless. It isn't. It's just that the assets that the USA has relied on for its dominance and power for so long are very rapidly showing themselves to be useless in the new ways of war. So I don't expect U.S. military dominance to last more than another 10 years. I expect it will be shown up very quickly and will be destroyed. And a big part of the reason why it will be destroyed is because of the influence of the deep state. See, you have to understand something. The deep state in China is nationalistic. The deep state in the United States is not nationalistic. The deep state in the U.S. exists to further its own power. The deep state in China exists to further its own power in the name of China. Okay? That's the difference. Xi Jinping, as I was saying, is somebody who represents everything that the deep state will become in the United States. No popular basis for his leadership, no power base beyond, you know, people who he's done favors for, which, by the way, is a pretty powerful power base, and a lot of connections with billionaires who have a vested interest in using the levers of power of government to achieve their own ends. That's what the United States' future looks like if the deep state isn't checked. That's what the Flynn case represents an opportunity to get away from. Now, what do you do with a deep state in power? How do you deal with a situation like that? It's very difficult. If a deep state entrenches itself in power like that, the destruction of its host nation is guaranteed within a generation, or thereabouts. It's happened before, and it'll happen again. The existence of a deep state in charge of a nation is never a good thing for that nation. If you look at China, for instance, again, coming back to the Sterling example of a deep state in charge of things, what happens when you have deep state forces in charge? Well, China has already embarked on imperialist, expansionist projects using the exact same template that the British used against the Chinese and against Africa and against India and against everyone else, very successfully. The way that the Chinese are approaching this is to offer countries exceptionally attractive loans, and then using those loans will essentially take over that country's infrastructure. This is a tactic that they actually learned not from the British, but from the IMF and the World Bank, the economic hitmen of the 1970s and 1980s. Very effective strategy, by the way. Great way to enslave third world countries into debt traps. And very, very, very efficient. It results in massive amounts of captured resources for the country that goes about doing it. And it has worked in the past and will continue to work in the future. It's a very effective strategy if you have the financing for it. So, at any rate, what you're seeing right now is China engaging in the very same kinds of imperial ambitions that the American deep state has engaged in for decades. And eventually it will lead to the collapse of the Chinese economy. They can't sustain it any more than America can. In fact, they are, for all that people say the Chinese economy is stronger than America's, I have never believed that for a moment. I have never believed it because the deep state, one of the characteristics of the deep state in any part of the world that it operates in, is that it cannot bear to hear the truth. In China, it is impossible to know what the economic truth really is, because any bad news is suppressed. The way that the deep state operates in China, which is to say the way the Communist Party operates in China, is that you have the central government, and then you have local officials spread out throughout all the provinces. The local officials have very strong incentives not to report how bad things actually are to the center, because if they report on how bad things are, they will lose funding, they will lose chances to gain access to the center and to go to the center and you know, make something of themselves. They will, above all, they will lose face. And to understand how important this is, you have to understand the East Asian mentality. In Asia, obedience to higher authority is absolutely paramount. You cannot disobey higher authority. And the concept of being right or of moral virtue is extremely important. So if you are ever wrong, you can never actually admit that you're wrong, because that means that you lose social standing. Someone who is wrong, who has done something wrong, is a leper, a pariah. He needs to be cast out. The concept of losing face is of vital importance, and it's literally that. I mean, if you've done something wrong and you walk into a room, nobody will look at you, nobody will look at your face. Everyone will just look away from you. It's social ostracism of the worst kind, and it's extremely effective. It is literally as though you have no face. If you lose standing in an Asian organization, it's 1,000 times worse than losing standing in a Western organization, because it means that you have somehow done something wrong. You have failed your superiors, and doing so is catastrophic to your own prospects for advancement. It is for this reason, for instance, that the Asians have invented many very bizarre rituals for regaining their honor, for paying a price for their mistakes. One of the most infamous of these is the way that the Yakuza retainers basically cut off parts of their fingers. So, for instance, if a Yakuza henchman fails his master, his mob boss, the price for that failure may well be the foremost knuckle of his pinky finger. This doesn't sound like that big a deal until you realize that the pinky finger is basically another thumb on the hand. And if you don't believe me, try gripping something without your pinky involved. It's much, much harder to do. It's like having a second non-opposable thumb on the end of your hand. If you must lose a finger, lose your ring finger, okay? It's much better for you that way. But if you lose the pinky, then your ability to grip anything is greatly diminished. You're not gonna have anything like the same grip strength, and your things will slip out of your grasp very easily. So, if you lose face in that manner, the price that you will have to pay is quite fearsome and quite terrible. The same is true of the deep state in the USA and in the UK, and anywhere else in the West, actually. The price for failure is to be cast out, to be thrown out onto the streets as human garbage. I think the best illustration you can find of this is if you watch the Netflix series Altered Carbon, and you look at the way that the Methuselahs interact with their retainers. The retainers have great fear of falling out of favor with their pretty much immortal, extraordinarily wealthy, extraordinarily powerful benefactors. If that happens, they get cast onto the streets below, you know, kilometers below, onto street level, and they live in squalor and shit. In order to gain access to the deep state, you literally have to sell your soul. And that's an apt metaphor. To become one of the chosen in the deep state requires that you take the ticket, you buy the ticket, and you take the ride. But you can't ever withdraw from that. The cost is your soul, and you will be destroyed in taking that ticket. So to do so is incredibly dangerous to you and to everything that you stand for. So how, in that case, do you go about destroying something like the deep state? Well, this is where the truth comes in. This is where the power of truth comes in. The one thing that the deep state cannot withstand is direct exposure to truth and light. That is how you set about destroying them. That is, for instance, how the Communist Party in China will eventually be destroyed. Because the Communist Party is a series of lies stacked on top of other lies, topped off with lies on the side. The economic miracles, quote-unquote, of China's growth is, it's real, there is something behind that, certainly, but the reports of ghost cities in China, which are just, you know, entire cities built with nobody inhabiting them, point to the existence of a colossal debt bubble. A debt bubble that defies human comprehension. I mean, we think it's bad in the United States. It's quite possibly worse in China. When that bubble collapses, as it has collapsed actually several times in the past, most Westerners don't know about this, but there have been a number of real estate crashes in Shanghai, which resulted in huge losses to banks and credit organizations in China. They were very quietly bailed out by China's central government. Now, the size of those bubbles keeps growing and growing and growing. And the Chinese government doesn't have infinite amounts of money. I mean, it likes to pretend it does. And it's the only country in the world that can buy the kind of debt that the United States will have to issue very soon. But it's also not capable of financing that kind of expansion on its own. If you look at China's debt to GDP ratio, okay, if you look at the actual national debt of China, as of July 18th last year, China's debt to GDP ratio is absolutely horrifying. You think America's is bad at, you know, 130% of GDP right now, which is what it is. It's about $24 trillion. China's debt to GDP ratio is 300%, okay? 300%. That is astonishing. And the reason why it's so high is simply because it needs to keep funding these state-run enterprises. The level of indebtedness of Chinese companies and corporations is pretty terrifying. The reality is that they do not have the ability to fund themselves and maintain themselves and, you know, stay alive on their own. There are zombie corporations all over China with tremendous amounts of bad debt. China's bad debt problem may be possibly the worst in the world. I mean, it's worse than India's. And India has an appalling bad debt problem. Over 90% of the bad debt held in India is held by the State Bank of India and other government-run banks, government, you know, public sector banks. The private sector is in remarkably good financial shape, especially if you look at private sector banks such as HDFC, ICICI, and Bandhan Bank. These banks are very, very well run because they don't have government backstops the way that SBI does. In China, that concept doesn't really exist. The separation between private and public banking doesn't really exist. I mean, you know, nitpickers will argue, of course, there's a difference between a public bank and a private bank in China. You know, duh, what are you talking about, Didact? No, there isn't. Ultimately, they are always arms of government policy. Ultimately, that's simply the case. They are arms of government policy. The deep state can be defeated, but it takes tremendous amounts of effort to do it once they're sort of lodged in. Once the cancer has lodged in a country's heart, the result is almost always terminal. That is where His Most Illustrious Celestial Majesty, the God Emperor, comes in. He has been fighting a very difficult battle for the last 4 years to uproot the deep state and to expel it. Now, to those of us on the outside, it doesn't look like he's had much success. America is still in Afghanistan. America is still in Iraq. America is still promoting war around the world. America is still spying on its own citizens with abandon. America is still engaged in pointless efforts to bully the rest of the world into compliance with its own directives. But stand back for a moment and look at the real situation. The deep state has tried repeatedly and desperately to get the Trump administration involved in yet more wars around the world. What's actually happened? Has the United States gone to war in Syria? No. Has the United States gone to war against Iran? No. Has the United States gone to war against China? No. Has the United States gone to war against Russia? No. Has the United States restored some sense of legitimacy and rule of law? Yes. Are the intelligence agencies running scared? Yes. Is the FBI being exposed as corrupt to its very core? Yes. Are the national intelligence agencies being exposed for their corruption and their treason? Yes. Time after time, you see the God Emperor acting in what seems to be, at first, a very reckless way. I mean, that ridiculous chemical weapons attack in Syria back in 2017, you know, news came out of this appalling, horrific, terrible chemical weapons attack, where Assad gassed his own people, and the God Emperor responded by bombing an airfield in Syria, and it launched cruise missiles, and he was ridiculed. First he was applauded by the media for, you know, CNN was like, oh yes, this is a wonderful thing, this is a great thing, the president has shown how tough he is, he's bombed Syria, and he sent a message to the Assad regime. Now we need to follow it up. Except the God Emperor didn't follow it up. He didn't send in any troops. He didn't send in any occupying forces. He didn't try to sort out the mess himself. He basically told all the parties involved in a giant fustercluck in that part of the world, figure it out yourselves, and pulled American troops out a couple of years later. He did not escalate the situation. He bombed an airfield which was restored back to full working functionality within a few hours. That was it. He was given an opportunity to attack Iran by bombing several of its facilities after an Iranian attack which killed several U.S. citizens. He aborted that attack at the last moment because his generals lied to him. They lied to him about the casualty figures. And he put a good spin on it. He said, he asked the generals, how many people would it kill? And they said, a couple hundred. And he said, no, that's too many. That's disproportionate for, you know, shooting down one of our drones. Pull it back. Don't I cancel the attack, abort the mission. The generals lied to him. They knew what the casualty figures were likely to be. They tried to downplay the estimates. And when he came at them and he said, no, I want the actual estimates, they came back and said, sir, it's going to be about 150 to 200 people. And he said, no, not doing it. Then he launched a direct strike against General al-Sulaymani of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. Now, this was decried at the time as a very dangerous provocation. The Iranians regarded it as such and vowed to launch a series of terrible retaliation strikes, which would leave the United States cowering and, you know, weeping and so on and so forth. And there is good reason to argue that the attack against Soleimani, the assassination of Soleimani, was a very big mistake, because Soleimani was one of the reasons why Al-Qaeda, or I should say ISIS, was pushed back in Iraq. Because Iran actually intervened in Iraq with Iranian-backed and trained Quds Force-trained militias to push back ISIS. And these militias worked with the United States and the Iraqi government to defeat ISIS. So Soleimani was actually instrumental to U.S. policy in the region to push back ISIS. And now he's dead, and he's been replaced by some, you know, nowhere near as competent functionary. But look at what Iran did in response. They shot off a bunch of missiles at American targets, but they gave the Americans ample warning. They told them like 90 minutes, more than that, in fact, before the missiles were launched. Hey, by the way, we're gonna shoot a bunch of rockets your way. Get your people out of there. The Americans pulled back because they took it seriously. The rockets did absolutely no appreciable damage to anybody. And the God Emperor basically said, yep, everything's fine, we're all good. The Iranians rattled their sabers. They shot down a Ukrainian aircraft, for which they were roundly and rightly condemned. And business, you know, life resumed as usual. The God Emperor had every opportunity to go to war on behalf of the deep state. He had every opportunity to become a deep state puppet. And he didn't. Why? Because he showed the deep state the truth. It's like, you know, the picture of Dorian Gray. The one thing that Dorian Gray couldn't withstand was the image of his own sins reflected back upon him. That's the truth of the deep state. Men like James Comey, John Brennan, Jim Clapper, all of these men who have done such evil in the name of so-called good and have led the United States down such terrible paths are being confronted with the truths of their misdeeds. And even if they're not hauled up in front of a court and condemned for what they've done, even if they're not sent to prison for what they've done, which they absolutely should be, the evidence against them is overwhelming at this point. They absolutely should spend the rest of their lives in prison, along with much of the leadership of the DNI, the CIA, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, BATFE, and God knows how many other federal agencies that have done so much to abuse the trust and the safety of the American people. These people should be behind bars, there's no question of that. But they are being exposed one by one. There is simply too much going on around the world, or at least in America, I should say, where government officials are suddenly very mysteriously dying or being arrested as part of pedophile rings, or going missing, or fleeing the country. Something's going on here. And I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not a Q conspiracy nut, because I think that while the Q conspiracies have proven to be right on a number of levels, they've also been shown repeatedly wrong in some of his other predictions. But I do think that there's something very interesting going on behind the scenes. So when it comes to deep-sixing the deep state, all that you need is the truth. That's absolutely the only thing that's necessary. All that you need to do is expose the lies of these people to the sunlight, And then all of a sudden you realize they can't stand it. They can't deal with being shown their own ugly selves. Once you do that, the deep state starts to crumble. Whether it's in the United States, where the deep state will be destroyed through its own recklessness and malfeasance and through the God Emperor shining a light directly on their malfeasance, or in China, where the deep state will, which is to say the Communist Party, will eventually collapse under the weight of its own contradictions, both economic and political, or in Israel, where the deep state, which is essentially the judiciary at this point, if you look at the way that the deep state has organized itself in Israel, and my friend Dawn Pine, the male brain, he's very much a valuable contributor to my blog. I mean, like, at least a third of the material that I post up every Monday is basically his material that I use. He sends it to me, and I assemble it, and it gets posted. It's really good. He can explain this much better than I can, but Israel has a deep state in operation itself. Britain has a massive deep state. Even Russia has a deep state of some kind, although it's under much tighter control because Vladimir Putin, the neo-tsar, he understands how that arm works, and he has such a strong power base himself that the deep state has never really been able to dislodge him. The deep state in Russia is Jewish-led, or was, actually. If you look at the history of the rise of Putin, you'll realize that Jewish oligarchs were heavily behind funding him and financing him. But when he came to power, he turned around and destroyed them in turn. He refused to allow himself to be used as their puppet, the way that his predecessor, Boris Yeltsin, had allowed himself to be used. If you look at the history of men like Mikhail Khodorkovsky, or Boris Berezovsky, or Roman Abramovich, Jews, all of them, they were forced out of power and out of influence by Putin. Even if you look at men like Oleg Deripaska, Deripaska was the tycoon at the head of Rusal, Russia's biggest aluminium manufacturer. For my American listeners, that's how it's pronounced. Aluminium. You lot have been pronouncing it incorrectly for 250 years. Get used to it. Anyway, Deripaska is a Putin flunky, but if you look at him, you know, from like 20 years ago, he got his ass reamed by Putin for the closure of some of his factories. So Putin understands how the deep state operates in his country, and he understands how to keep them in line. If you look around the world, the answer to the deep state is to shine the light of truth upon them. And that's exactly what the God Emperor is doing. God bless him for that, because we need a hell of a lot more of it. Unless these people are exposed and destroyed, they will lead to the destruction of the United States as a nation. The destruction of the USA as an empire is guaranteed. Okay, it's going to happen. But the nation of the United States is still there. It's still out there. I mean, when the collapse finally happens, which will probably be in about 10 years to 15 years' time, the USA will probably separate into three, maybe four distinct groups or confederations. And at least two of those will be inheritors of the American nation. They will basically be the American nation. With some distinct tribal differences between them. The other one or two, you know, confederations will be probably proto-communist and proto-fascist in nature. So, you know, that's not something to look forward to, but here's what it is. Anyway, we've reached the 1 hour mark, more or less, so I will wrap things up now. I hope you enjoyed listening to this. I hope you understand now the nature of deep state involvement and what it's like and what makes it up and how to defeat it. And above all, I want to tell you, don't lose hope, because the deep state will be defeated one way or another. This isn't the first time we've seen deep states around the world. This won't be the last. They will be destroyed one way or another. This has been The Didact, and this was Didactic Mind, episode 29, Deep Sixing the Deep State.